Is it ever someone else's fault we suffer? All right. So we, as Les said, we're next to last on the Eightfold Path. And just a brief review. The first two are right view and right intention, and they provide a broad kind of a mindscape of what the path is. And then we touched on right speech, action, and livelihood, which are the behaviors of the Eightfold Path. And as we're going from a broader scape kind of down to more personal, we eventually go into the last three, which are more on concentration. That is effort, mindfulness, which is tonight, and the next time will be concentration. And this takes the practice down to a very intimate place inside of us where suffering occurs, liberation occurs, freedom. All the things that we learn as we're going down the path occur down at this deeper level. So I've got three definitions I want to go through too. So the first is mindfulness is defined really in the Buddhist realm. It comes from the Pali word sati and usually defined as mindfulness, referring to the presence of mind needed to have a strong and balanced awareness. And balance might be eclectic, and that is you're not just aware of one thing and another, but you've got a broad awareness. You can see the topic in all of its details and not just a small piece of it. We then take mindfulness and have a mindfulness practice, and this is when it's combined with a clear comprehension, devotion to do it, and a willingness to put aside preoccupations with the material world, all the stuff that entails applying oneself to it. And this may only be in the moment. This is kind of one thing I like about Buddhism. They don't just say you reach the state and that's as far as you need to go and you don't need to do anything else. Everything is from moment to moment. And so when we do a practice, you may be practicing one moment, but you may fall off the wagon and not do it the next. But then you get back on the moment after that. It's the same thing with the mindfulness practice. And that is, you may be wonderfully mindful for a while, but as we will discover later on, there are certain areas that will pull you out of the mindfulness. And then lastly, we take the mindfulness practice and we inform it by the four foundations of mindfulness. And then that is when we have what is called right mindfulness in the Eightfold Path. Okay. So the four foundations of mindfulness are, the first one is awareness of body. This has to do with breathing and physical activities and sensation. The body is where the work begins, and it's learning to settle the body and pay attention to what's going on. In the beginning, this can be difficult. The mental momentums we have with our attachments and with our lives and with, quote, our occupations, they're so strong that we feel we just can't sit still. This may feel too difficult, especially when paired with things you may want to think that are more important, such as, you know, what I do, what I want to have. And these are produced by our attachments. One might even say, I'd love to come to Sashin, but I've just got too many things to do. Now, I had to put that little commercial in because this Saturday we do have a Sashin coming. All right. In my experience, this is one of the maladies of Silicon Valley. And I have personal experience. I was going to relate an anecdote. About, I want to say 12 years ago, I'd risen and gotten to a position that had a lot of stress. And I had some relationship problems going on, and that was kind of this mental illness cocktail that really had me under the weather. And a friend took me to the side and said, you look pretty terrible. I have a therapist I'd like you to go see. And so I acquiesced and went to see him. And so in the first session, he said, I want you to sit in the chair over there, and I want you to close your eyes. I want you to tell me what you experienced. So I sat in the chair and closed my eyes. I said, there's a lawnmower outside. And then there's an airplane I can hear flying over. And then, you know, there's somebody walking down the hall. And he said, no, I want you to tell me what's going on with your body. Okay. I said to Ryle, I said, the chair is really soft. And they said, no, inside your body. Well, that took me a little bit longer. And I sat there and I said, well, I've got an itch right here and things like that. Well, eventually got to, I said, I'm feeling stressed. This is after 20 minutes. So I'm feeling stressed. I can feel it from here down to my navel. And we kind of got into it. And at some point right around then, everything just lifted off. I had this euphoric feeling without all that stress and depression. It lifted off of me. And I said, you are fantastic. It was an answer to a dream in some ways. Well, he said, okay, I'll see you next Wednesday. And I left, and of course within 4 hours, all the stuff was back again, right? But what that left me with was with an experience of what it could be. Not what I had, but what it really could be to have a practice like that. And I had not been paying attention to the body. Upon paying attention to it, I may be the only person on planet Earth that ever happened to, but it definitely made me feel well. So I stayed with him for about 6 months or so, and he kept talking about being the observer and looking at things, and it became apparent to me after a while, the observer, me, was the thing that need all the work on, not just all this other stuff. So I left him and I bought some books on meditation and started doing that and started truly getting my body. I could feel it. And a friend then said, hey, I've got this Buddhist place down in Mountain View. I came down to Canada about a year after doing the meditation. And again, about a year or two later, I woke up one morning and I said, you know, I've got all this stress on this one side and I've got mental health on the other. Which one do I want? Do I want the stressful job? Do I want mental health? Stressful job, mental health. And I said, oh, of course, I want the stressful job. No. I said, I'm going for the mental health. And within about 6 months, I left the job. And to appreciate, not that my hardship was there, but I had a mortgage, I had two kids, a marriage, and all this kind of stuff. And I thought I had to have this job to make the money to make this all happen. Well, we all didn't die. We all stayed in the same house. But I managed to get out of that. And I realized at that point, it was up to me to make decisions of what direction my life was going to go. And what happened was, I think, during the meditation was, I kind of got down to a new mental homeostasis. Before, I had this background stress always there, always feeling behind, always feel something was required. I wasn't quite along far enough in the project, stuff like that. And I began to think that's just how my mind was. I was constantly in that state. But after that, I realized, no, there is a far more blissful way, a far more free way of living life. And when I'm not there, something needs to be worked on. And so, anyway, that is awareness of the body. All right, number two, awareness of feeling tones. These feelings come from either the outside of the five senses or they're conjured up in your mind, right? And they originate, obviously, not in the five senses. So. Again, the practice on this one is to notice whether pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Not that you're supposed to label them and say, okay, I'm feeling this, okay, is that pleasant or non-pleasant? It should be second nature that you know what you're feeling, pleasant or unpleasant. And it has to do with being aware of what's going on with you. Instead of being unconscious and not knowing how you feel about something, now you're starting to feel it at a rather elementary level, but nevertheless a very important level. And with awareness, here one does investigate, where in the body do you feel it? And that's sometimes difficult to do. So this categorization is important because we're not adverse to the idea or anything like that. We're adverse to how the idea makes us feel. So when you're feeling unpleasant about something, you probably don't like it very much. When it does feel good, you're probably drawn toward it. It isn't because the logic is beautiful or this. It's really a visceral feeling you have inside of you. We also begin to see that this inner world you tend to look at then your existential life as having an outside and an inside. An outside is where all the stuff takes place. Inside is where, once again, is where all the peace and the freedom reside. And you begin to see that the inner world is the only place we can experience freedom and well-being. And see that they aren't caused by a continual diet of pleasures and experiences on the outside. This is something completely different that guards that inside area. Freedom isn't based on conditions around us, but rather on something within, which is coming soon. And one thing I do, we have the first week in every month, we have an intro to Zen talk, and we have half a dozen. Les is one of the teachers, and I do a talk, and Chris and Dave do talks and stuff like that. But I like to do a question when I get everybody, we get it all back in the Sangha room, and it's maybe three or it may be 10 people. And I always ask the question of, why did you come here and not go to Stanford Shopping Center? And they laugh, that's funny. But it's kind of a meaningful question. I've yet to have somebody say, well, because I've discovered that the outside world is not how I find freedom, and I want to come to Canada for meditative practice. They haven't quite said that yet, but eventually they will. It's almost an unconscious feeling or draw that this may be an answer to something they have not found elsewhere. Now, this categorization, pleasant and unpleasant and neutral, is actually more powerful than it seems. It seems very simplistic. But have you ever been with a group of people and nobody can make up their mind what to do? You know, it's like, hey, I'm hungry. Let's all go to dinner. Where do you want to go? Oh, I don't care. It doesn't bother me. I can go any place, right? Where do you want to go? Ah, it doesn't matter to me. I don't care. Let's just go someplace, okay? No. We don't care either. Somebody make a decision, right? This is kind of a classic. If you actually try to take stock of yourself, you'd probably say, no, I want to go to Romanian wild boar place tonight, and this is what I want to eat, right? You would probably be, it's easier to make sense of what's going on, and there's less of the mental deliberation, which usually confounds or complicates the situation. All right. Next one is awareness of our mental state. This is sometimes called the heart state or heart practice. In short, this is about becoming aware of the mental quality that we're in at the moment, our mood, whether one is on top of the world or in a funk. Here one learns through observation the truths about the quality of one's mind. For example, the truth of impermanence. Mental states rarely stay at the same over time. Sometimes they're hot and sometimes they're not. The instruction is just to notice a shift in quality and characteristics. Finally, the last one, awareness of mental processes, which is called truth. In this last step, we take an awareness gained from the earlier steps and develop wisdom to know what is true about one's mind and one's attachments. The task here is to realize how it operates. We see that our condition doesn't arise spontaneously, but comes from the causes and conditions. One becomes familiar with the actions that produce a heart that's happy and at peace, and the actions that produce a heart that's afraid or stressed. That leads to taking responsibility for ourselves and realizing that we are, I love this word, custodian of our inner quality. I remember when I was in grade school in Kansas, we had these people that would come in and clean the rooms and, you know, sweep and stuff. They were the school custodians. And I like this term, custodian of our inner quality, right? We're the one that cleans the place up and straightens it up and makes sure it's all working right. It isn't anybody else that does that. We're the custodians of ourselves. And this can take courage and a lot of self-forgiveness. You know, there's a lot of atrocities down in here I have to kind of front and take care of that are very difficult, painful, and take a lot of courage to do sometimes. And coupled with that is one needs to learn how to forgive themselves too. Make mistakes, forgive yourself, and go on. Now, what I like about Buddhism, there really isn't a sin in Buddhism. You make mistakes, but you stop doing them and you go on and not have to go back. Okay. So there is a fellow in the area, Paul Holler, who, longtime Bay Area Buddhist practitioner, I think he was also abbot of San Francisco Zen Center, probably more than once. Actually, set right in the spot here, kind of a sacred spot just because Paul said here. But he said that practice is about moving away from the stories and moving towards truth. Moving away from the falsehoods and the non-truths over to truth and letting that stuff go. I love that. It's kind of poetic. And it simplifies it a lot. You tell you, if you get wound up in your own story, there's a lot of untruths in that. Move away from it and go towards the truth. All right, we're in the home stretch here. All right, so that's the four foundations of mindfulness. So the homework assignment for extra credit is, in Buddhism there are five areas called the hindrances, where one can lose our mindfulness and attention because we're caught up in desires and aversions. So the task is to start to notice how one gets caught in a hindrance, the feelings, emotions, and beliefs that lead one to desire something, and once captured, what steps do you need to take to free yourself from them? All right. In summary, Mindfulness just isn't being aware of suffering. It's deeply understanding the cause, effect, and conditions that underlie one's suffering and apply wisdom gained through the meditation and observation to achieve freedom from future suffering. We start with the body and the awareness of breathing and stabilize the tension on the body. Then begin noticing the flavors of feelings, pleasant and unpleasant, and neither. That helps us to separate our inner world from the external world. We start sensing then the inner world where suffering, happiness, and freedom reside and notice how they change with time. That produces a point of view, a new mental homeostasis that leads us to the awareness that cause and effect conditions on the shifting nature of our inner life. Finally, this gives us guidance in choosing the skillful actions that make positive consequences in our life. For example, right speech, right action, and right livelihood. It isn't by accident that we feel the way we do. In the words of the Dalai Lama, happiness is not something ready-made. It comes from our own actions. It's not what we do. It's what we do, excuse me, not what we get that grows the happiness. Okay, so back to the original question. Is it ever someone else's fault that we suffer? No, I could answer that. Maybe. I think in the purest sense, I think it'd be a brave person who would say, if you could say, from now on, will it never be somebody's fault that you suffer? I think it would take a lot of courage to say that, or either that or somebody that was insincere. Because life's pretty tough. And I don't take it as somebody's fault that I suffer. I suffer being around certain people. The reason why I left that job, I worked for a fellow for 6 years, and he was driving me crazy. Very mercurial, very sarcastic. He was not a personality builder. He was a squelcher. Now, I don't blame him. I mean, however bad I felt around him, I'm sure he felt much worse between his ears. And maybe that's one aspect there. He was kind of a miserable guy. But it wasn't his fault that I felt that way. It was my responsibility to take care of it. And instead of saying, I can tough this out, I can beat this rap, I said, I recognize my own capabilities and weaknesses and said, no, I need to get out of here. I'll get healthy and then I can get on with getting better, so to speak. It is about taking responsibility of one's life. That's my answer. Anybody have another answer? Anybody want to say, yeah, it's always somebody else's fault. Nobody's brave enough to say that, are they? Yes, Dave.
Well, of course, the sort of simple answer is, of course, it's not ever anybody else's fault. Your suffering is your own responsibility. But that's a very sort of isolating kind of way to look at it. And what you said about how there are certainly, it's silly to deny that there are other people, and you notice that when you're around them, you feel bad. I remember years ago going to a remarkable theater performance of Eugene O'Neill's Long Day's Journey Into Night, and listening to the dialogue and the suffering that was going on in this family, the image that came to my mind was that they were like a bunch of finely tuned string instruments, and one string would start to vibrate and it would resonate with an emotional string and another one, and then that would pass on to them. The energy and the suffering move around among them because the delusions and the grasping and the suffering of each of them was resonating with the others. Yeah, and I think, you know, one answer then to your question is it's somebody else's fault. It's our fault that we suffer together. Mm-hmm. Our suffering resonates with someone else. And maybe you can jointly fix that and through compassion you can address it together. Or maybe if you can't do that, you can't always fix it. Maybe you have to just not put yourself in that situation. That's what you mean. To just say it is or isn't somebody else's fault seems like it's neither or.
Yeah, I thank you, Dave. I thought maybe when I was mulling this thing over myself, I have four children, and I'm terrified when I say this. if one of them were to die, I would feel an immense loss. And I would fully expect part of that loss would probably stick with me the rest of my life. Now, is that suffering? I don't know. But I think that's, I'm only conjecturing. Maybe I wouldn't, but I strongly suspect I would, because I love them all four very deeply. And those of you who have children, maybe can you imagine? Would not be pleasant. So, not my child's fault, that's for sure. I think, I didn't say would you suffer because of somebody, but I don't think I could find myself blaming somebody for my problem that I was suffering. Right? Well, that's not a right way to say it, but I think you did a much better job. Yeah, yeah. Bonnie.
So things happen that I don't predict or feel I have any control over, like someone might yell at me or push me, and that's an outside stimulus that enters through my body, through the senses, goes through my mind, and can cause pain. However, then there's all the meaning that I attach to it that can put suffering on top of suffering or suffering on top of pain. And that part I'm responsible for. It's entirely inside me. So I guess there's things that cause initial pain or discomfort, and then there's the suffering that we add on top of that that is maybe unnecessary. And probably the majority of it is the unnecessary suffering that we add on top and the meanings that we make. And also those replaying records where, oh, that person said that, and I'm never going to forget, and I replay it 100 times, but they only said it once. And that's me holding on to my suffering or pain. So, I'd say it's not always my fault, but most of the time. Most of the time it's right here. Yeah, I'm pushing my own buttons. Yeah,
maybe two comments. I agree. I think suffering and pain are two different things. Maybe pain, suffering is pain, but pain is not necessarily suffering. When you experience pain, the loss, or somebody's rude to you and you're caught unawares and you, oh, that wasn't very nice. But you let it go without too much story. As Paul said, move away from the story, go back to the truth. Yeah, I got my feelings hurt a bit, but I need to go on to the next thing I need to do. And then I forgot the second thing I was going to say. But yeah, that was very good. Thank you. Philippe.
There's this saying, I don't know if it's a real saying, or maybe you can tell me, but what you said reminded me of this saying, would you get angry at the wind? Have you heard that before?
Yeah.
Would you get angry at the wind? No.
Well, it sounds kind of Buddhistic, beautiful.
You know, if there was an earthquake and it created a lot of pain for you personally, you know, would you get angry at the San Andreas Fault?
Mm.
So you wouldn't probably get angry at the San Andreas Fault. And the parallel in terms of being hurt by other people, I think, is you could take an example. Let's say there's someone going around and they're doing really bad stuff. They say that they're a murderer, right? And then there's an examination of their brain, and we discover that there's a tumor in the brain that caused them to be this way. When the tumor is removed, the person is perfectly normal. So that knowledge of that person having a tumor in their brain would actually, I think, change our perception of this person's actions. And so we would go from, oh, here's a really bad person killing people, they're the murderer, to, and you know, they didn't have any choice, they just went around. It would make it more to go into the category of the San Andreas Fault, I think, in terms of our perception. But if we take this thought to its logical conclusion, everybody's brain has something in it that causes them to act in a certain way. It might not be a tumor, it might be something else. It might be some imbalance in a hormone, it might be, you know, the mind is very complicated. And so I wonder whether trying to see people more in the light of, okay, well, they're behaving in a certain way, it's not clear that, you know, it's not clear that what they're doing, I don't know how to phrase this very well, but instead of just blaming people for their action, maybe they're acting from ignorance, they're acting from hormonal imbalance, they're acting from all sorts of reasons that we can't know. And so, I don't know how we can ever blame people given those circumstances. You know, that might be an easier way to deal with suffering caused by people.
You're making a very beautiful point. That's true. I don't. There's kind of a mind. I'm trying to think. Not experiment, but a story where they say, think of these two incidents. The first incident, you're in a boat, you're on a lake, and you're kind of gliding across this lake. You're lying on your back, you're in the sun, you're not seeing where you're going. And bang, you run into a pole in the lake. And you go, oh, I ran into a pole in the lake. And you get, you know, get away on the pole and go back to the start. Next experience is, you're same thing, you're lying in the boat, you're kind of gliding across the lake, and bang, you run into something. And you look over, and somebody else on another boat has run into you. Now, do you think you'd respond the same way to that person as you responded to that pole, or would you say, what the heck are you doing? So, I think to your point, Philippe, we kind of develop why something's happening in, with our story, and usually, not usually, I shouldn't say that, sometimes you'll make the fault and the reason and the motivation far worse than it ever really is. See the worst in the situation. You could see the best in the situation. Oh, that was just an accident. And then you come to find out the person had a bad day or this or that or and a great mental stress, and that's why they're behaving. And you're taking the point of view that they're wonderfully mentally healthy, and yet they're just being mean to you for doing this. So coming back to the self all the time and saying it's all about me and all done to me. Yeah. That was very nicely put. Yes?
My name is Sherry.
Hi, Sherry.
I'm thinking, my predator told me something the other day, that he read a study, of course, take it with a grain of salt, these are many articles and studies, but he read that we have 65,000 thoughts throughout the day, and generally 45,000 of those thoughts are negative or filled with suffering. The rest, the 20,000, are the positive thoughts that we have. Most of the time, we attach to the negative thought. We can make the conscious choice not to. Even though there's more of the negative thoughts, there's 20,000 beautiful ones. So I just wanted to mention that.
That's very good. There's, and I forgot his book, Viktor Frankl, for the therapist who... The psychiatrist has spent a couple of years in Auschwitz. He said they could take everything away from you with the power of choice. So you could lose everything they did in those camps, but they could never take the power of choice away from the people that choose what they were going to do about it, which is kind of profound. Sometimes we think we have no choice. We're backed against a wall. I can't make... When I was with that job, I didn't think I could leave. I didn't think I would survive if I left. I had an identity there, and that was going to be gone, and I didn't know what it was going to be. But when finally my head got clear enough, or my mind got clear enough, I could see an obvious choice of why in the heck would I want to stick with something that wasn't working for me. So, yeah, very nice. Thank you. Todd.
I have to say, it seems like in all honesty that we do blame very easily. Can I get here? Night and the woman is just not turning right. But I think the difference is actually recognizing that that's what you're doing. And I think that's the bigger step.
Hmm. So I don't disagree with you. I think we ought to have Road Rage Anonymous or something. You know? We should have Road Rage Anonymous because I would probably, Les, please cover your ears. I think I would probably get, I would probably be a member. And I realize it's kind of an addiction. It's almost like a game, like, why did he do that? Or, you know, and I've let myself go a little bit with that. And I know now I need to put some attention and pull back from that because it's one thing, it's silly and it's not a positive thing to do, but okay, so I really do that, I confess. I'm doing it less though. I'm pulling it back and doing less because it is kind of ridiculous. But, yeah.
I think that this practice allows you to maybe the possibility of being, I guess, say a watcher or an observer and allow this to kind of be rather than have some kind of ideal. In fact, I don't blame anybody, which I think is bullshit. I think everybody, all the time. But being able to catch it, kind of, or to find it interesting, to be intrigued by it, and in that observation allows you to navigate in another way.
That's a nice glass half full type thing. Yeah, thank you. Yes.
I was just thinking about that. I think there are two types of people. One, I would say, it's arrogance, who blame somebody else for their suffering always. So that's kind of arrogant. There needs to be a balance to look at yourself. Maybe the fault is not always somewhere else. But then there are people who don't blame for their suffering or, you know, I could be the reason for my own suffering. What am I doing wrong that I'm going through this suffering? It's always someone else. How can it be all the time someone else? Right? It's one or two times someone else, but all the time if I'm unhappy and suffering, how can it be someone else? Then the other type of people, if you see children who are going through bad times in family, they tend to blame themselves. That I did something wrong, that's why this is happening to me, and that's how things are not working. Women that are abused, they blame themselves, right? Or if there are old people, they are not being taken care of, they blame themselves. And you see often the counselors telling, it's not your fault, to keep them away from depression. So those are the people. They blame themselves for everything that's going on. So they are not able to come out of the suffering. So those are told that it's not your fault, it's somewhere else. Whereas there is another section where the fault is where they need to look into themselves and not somewhere else. So it both ways, I was thinking both ways. I think there is a balance needed. Sometimes it is your own fault, yes. But not always. I think Bali was saying most of the time it's my fault, but not always. So understanding, I mean, it's a very difficult, it's a tough life, you know, to make a choice and take ownership of when it's your own fault and come over it. And then another responsibility is like not blame yourself for everything. And that goes into inferiority complex or depression or less confidence. I don't know. So everything is expected. So it's kind of difficult, you know. There are two ways.
Hmm. Thank you.
This is something I have been contemplating. I am a trained therapist. I feel like when people suffer, you know, in a safe environment like this, like when we are telling ourselves that we are not good, or I wish this is cooler, hotter, better, something, I feel like that's, you know, suffering created by ourselves. But when people are actually in a physical danger, for example, like child victim of sexual abuse or domestic violence, it's very hard for me to say it's not a fault of the other person, because harm is done by other people, and it's hard for me to think that child has a choice to forgive or stay positive or be hopeful,
yeah,
while, you know, Buddhism promotes compassion, curiosity, and understanding. It's just it's hard. I guess probably there is no answer to it, but I just wanted to share my struggle.
Thank you. I was once married to a therapist, and she was going through her internship down at Giroretto, a place down in San Jose. I don't know if it's still there. But it was an abuse where they dealt with abuse and stuff. A lot of it was a child abuse. And we hadn't had any children yet, but I had a son. And she would come back, and she would talk about business. And after a while, I said, I don't want to hear it, because it was really upsetting to hear this stuff. And this is a question then. See, I don't think I could apply that question to somebody who wasn't aware of themselves, like a child, who didn't have the awareness, the experience, the knowledge to know how to deal with it, because it's still a confusing situation, and they're still their minds are somewhat unformed about cause and effect and what goes on, and being able to see something and make a proper judgment. So maybe all adults are caregivers, and yet this one hurts them. I don't know. I would pull that back and say, yes, maybe that person truly is, because this child is suffering. Or maybe really the child is being hurt very much and is just used to being hurt all the time. I don't know about the suffering aspect, but definitely the harm is done there. Boy, my hat's off to you to walk in that realm and keep your wits about you. That would be very hard for me, I know. Yeah, thank you so much. Yes?
I have a response to Shlomo, and it's kind of related to what all of you are saying. So the reason that children bring themselves, and a lot of times women as well, in violent situations, is actually for survival. The negative thinking, as you mentioned, there's like a much larger percentage of negative thoughts in general. If you burn your hand on a hot stove, you need to remember not to burn yourself again. Whereas if you saw a great movie and you forget you saw a great movie, you're not going to die. You're not going to cause pain. And so that's why we attach naturally more stronger to negative emotions. And for a child who truly is helpless in position with a full-sized adult,
yeah,
it's actually more terrifying for existentially to think, I am completely helpless and I could die right now, rather than think, I have some control, I must have done something wrong, I wasn't smart enough, I wasn't fast enough, I wasn't this,
yeah,
and that's why this happened to me. So in a sense, it's giving a false sense of control so that the child or disadvantaged person can find some way to keep moving forward. However, the only way they'll then be able to let go of that kind of depression or self-hatred will be is if they can get to a point where they're no longer in that same vulnerable position. Then they can see the truth. I was completely vulnerable and helpless, and I'm not now. And that's when healing begins, is to understand I was helpless then, and I'm not now. I was raped when I was 7. And I was alone then, and now I'm surrounded by friends, and I'm 25, and I'm not the same person now. And so really being able to separate the past from the present, mm-hmm, is key. But it's interesting, because we might think, you know, children are not yet formed, but actually they're their body and mind is doing what it needs to do to survive, even though it's engaging in a delusion that, you know, sometimes the parent might be abusing them, but that's also their source of food, their source of shelter. And if they try to take on and fight the grown adult, you know, who's going to win? So it's, you know, I really admire and appreciate everyone who does work in that area, because it's very difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so too, or would be. Yeah. Oh, yes.
So I've been thinking a lot about this conversation. Somebody said that the person who is with whatever act murder or whatever he may have, tumor in his brain, and that's what it's causing it. But I mean, there are so many really high profile, you know, these kind of very, very unfortunate examples. We had a Speaker of the House actually at certain Dennis Hastert, there was in Nebraska, there was, you know, the Franklin. They were supposed to be like taking orphanage, you know, some kind of an orphanage. It turned out to be, you know, the Franklin Credit Union. There's like so many examples, you know, in BBC, the high profile presenter, Jimmy Savile, and he says, hold on, you know, there was something in Penn State, you know, this kind of thing. You know, it doesn't matter if the child or the orphan knew whether this person had a tumor in the brain that is causing that, or whatever. Maybe they were themselves abused. I don't.
Yeah, there is a saying, children abused.
Maybe
abused children tend to be abusers themselves to a certain degree. Not always, they can break the chain, but there is a pathology that continues on down, generation to generation, until it's stopped. Ooh, yes. Hopefully a lighter topic. Yes.
I wanted to share an image, going back to your original question about, are other people responsible for our suffering? Are we responsible? Having had an experience with some therapy as well myself, that was a time when I was having a very, very difficult relationship with my mother. And I went to see a therapist for a long time to really try and, you know, beat this out. And we met every week and, you know, went through all these stories and tales and you know, these awful things that had been happening. And a few months passed and I sort of thought, you know, maybe it's time to wrap it up. I think we've sort of been through everything. And, you know, I sort of paid a lot of money. We came to the end of it.
Yeah.
And I think I sort of feel that we came to a consensus that it was probably all my mum's fault. But then where do you go from there? You know, how do you deal with it? And
yeah.
I remember the image that this person gave me, which I found very, very helpful. He said, look, the two of you, you're in a boat. You're in a very, very small boat in a big ocean. And the way you want to see it is, you know, your mother's done something. She's put herself in a place in the boat, and you're both going, whoop, and the boat's tipping over. And she's not going to move. All you have to do is get up and move and rebalance the boat. And just always keep rebalancing the boat. And I don't know, I found that image very, very useful, like not just with my mother, but in other situations with other people. You know, it's, I think we always kind of want the other person to change, you know, the other person to be sorry, the other person to atone for the thing that they've done. And actually, when I think of it in terms of just getting up and moving myself somewhere else to restore the balance, it's helped me a lot with personal relationships.
A saying comes to mind for me, of course you could say, well, it has a negative side too, but the power of a person is the ability to make things go right. So step outside yourself and rebalance the boat instead of sitting still and watching everything go. And powerful people do make things go right. Now, that's not always, because we see a lot of political things going now, very powerful people, and go, it's not going the right direction. But let's just speak about normal human beings, that, yeah, the power is the ability to make things go right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, good for you. Omar.
So, Monica was talking about child abuse. I was abused as a child. I went through sexual abuse, I went through physical abuse, I went through chemical abuse, and meaning I was given a lot of drugs. Mental drugs and weight enhancing drugs, and so strange thing was, like a year ago, and you know, it's like meditation has taken care of a lot of it, because I've seen that come up and I deal with it. But what has happened now is, like, one day my boss says to me, "Oh, if you keep going like this, I'm going to fire you." I looked him straight in the eye and said, "Okay, let's see what you got. Come on, dish that. You know, let's see what you got. Come on." And he was just, he was like, "What happened here?" Which is like, he wasn't ready for that. He was thinking, "I better back off." I said, "Come on, go ahead and fire me. Let's see what you got." So he was just like, he was completely taken aback by that. He didn't know what to do with me. I was like, I can't deal with this guy, you know. So he would try to come at me, and I would just throw him another line, something like that. It was just like, I was unnerving him constantly. But this, what you're talking about, is the two, three things that happen in meditation. Number one, it's you psychologically stop leaning on other people. That's one thing that happens. Number two that happens is you start seeing your own truth, you start seeing that you are not your behavior. You know, you've gone past that point which was like you were identifying with your behavior. You just go back past that. Once you go past that, you have gotten to that point where you are really going to the truth as to who you are. And once you get to that point, things sort of shift. And this is what things can happen. I mean, I was sitting there last Wednesday in the morning. I was in meditation. I was feeling as if an alligator and piranhas were eating away at my body. And I was just sitting there. And I was like, okay, most probably I don't need this. You want to keep my body? Keep my body. Go ahead. Take it away. You know, and it was just like, in like 2 minutes, it was just completely, that feeling was gone. There was nothing left out of that feeling. And this is what meditation can do, and this is what, you know, this is what our search is all about. Getting to that point. It's a certain kind of strength that comes out.
Yeah. Thank you. 9 o'clock?
Yeah,
3 minutes? You have a 3 minute question. No. Or we can stop here. Ah, Travis. 3 minutes now.
Just was thinking about how after a lifetime of, you know, simulation and blaming and other forms of excitement that the practice puts you in a safe place where survival isn't at stake, and in that safe place you get a very long, slow sobering that happens, and that's part of practice too. And you collect your thoughts, and what you said earlier about the body settling in first is so true. But there's composure, and but it's like ultra sober thing when you've been chasing or seeking or trying to achieve and compete.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So,
thank you. Yes, Teresa.
Yes. When the positive note, I was thinking now about, you know, when I went to a session in San Francisco in December, and they have a ceremony for Buddha's enlightenment, and so the ceremony was enchanting. We were moving around. It's not the center, but the place that they have on the first floor. And then we had some balls with petals, flowers, petals of flowers, and you know, we were throwing the petals at each other. And I thought it was such a beautiful experience, kind of, you know, acknowledging each other's beauty and the fact that we are all Buddhas. And I know that, you know, when you hear these stories about people abusing children and, you know, all the horrors that are happening in the world, it's kind of difficult to think that we are all beautiful, but it just was such an amazing experience, you know, wanted to share.
Mm. Thank you. We did this back in 2013, and I think I did write speech then. I thought that was the most important topic because I tend to shoot my mouth off a lot with that. I thought it was still appropriate. But if I remember right, there was a person who was going to do mindfulness, and they left. And he said, "We're going to get that." And I said, "I'll take that." And I went back and looked at my old notes, and I thought, "Well, I've come a little way since then." No, I haven't improved at all. But yeah, maybe I'm sure each step is equally important, but this one maybe is more important than most, just because I feel like you kind of learn who's, as Suzuki Roshi, who's really the boss, right? And whose responsibility it is to do something about yourself, and it's nobody else's. You really need it, it's really up to us to take care of ourselves. And this is not like an only one. You've got children to take care of too and stuff like that. But you can't blame asking something going on with you and say that somebody else needs to fix it. It just doesn't work that way. There's no growth in that. So I think it's the most important one, at least tonight, if no other.
Exciting.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Do we have announcements tonight?
So, leading on the positive note, we have a session coming up this Saturday and another, say, 3 days. So we have Thursday and Friday, and then Saturday we're going to have session. So our session is just a day-long tradition of sitting that we do here at this place, Kanjo. And it's a way for us, all of us, as a Sangha, to come together.